From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in Forum's opening hour this morning, Diane Ravitch is one of the nation's foremost education historians. She served as Assistant Secretary of Education in the Bush Senior Administration, and she helped craft the history of curriculum here in California. And she held views that she has now repudiated. We'll hear her story and find out from her why she shifted positions on education. And we'll discuss with her what she sees as ways to break through the present ongoing crisis in public education. An hour with your calls, emails, and online comments next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum. Diane Ravitch joins us for this Forum Hour, one of the country's premier education historians. She presently is a research professor of education at New York University and is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. She served as Assistant Secretary of Education in the George H.W. Bush administration and was appointed by President Bill Clinton to the National Assessment Governing Board, which oversees federal testing. A one-time supporter of the kind of educational reform that was based on testing, choice, accountability, marketing, and merit pay, she's now dramatically shifted her views, and she writes about why and how those changes took place in her thinking in her most recent book, which is called Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education. She also puts forth a plan to help stave off the ongoing public education crisis. And before we meet her officially, I wanted to just read a paragraph that appears early in her book to give you at least an overall sense of at least what she is spreading the message about here. She says, "It's time, I think, for those who want to improve our schools to focus on the essentials of education. We must make sure that our schools have a strong, coherent, explicit curriculum that is grounded in the liberal arts and sciences with plenty of opportunity for children to engage in activities and projects that make learning lively. We must ensure that students gain the knowledge they need to understand political debates, scientific phenomena, and the world they live in. We must be sure they are prepared for the responsibilities of democratic citizenship in a complex society. We must take care that our teachers are well-educated, not just well-trained, and we must be sure that schools have the authority to maintain both standards of learning and standards of behavior." Tall order, ambitious, but can be done, at least if you read her book. Diane Ravitch, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, actually, this title, The Death and Life of the Great American School System, echoes Jane Jacobs' book, which was put out in 1961 about cities, but you're talking about really resurrecting the schools, aren't you?
Well, I think that most people today would say that the American public education system is in trouble. Many people are ready to give up on it and to give it away to entrepreneurs and for-profit corporations and well-meaning amateurs. And I think we need public education. We need to make it better. Some people have said, as criticism of me and of this book, they say, "You're defending the status quo." But I'm not. I'm saying we need a much, much better public education system. And if we lose public education, we will lose something very important to our democracy.
And we can lose it. It's really a possibility, isn't it?
I think right now, well, I'm a historian of education, and having written about education for now 40 years, I'd say that we've been through lots of crises. I mean, there's always a crisis in education. That was one of my discoveries when I first was a graduate student in the 60s. There was a crisis in education every decade of the 20th century. But the critics didn't They wanted to make education better. They wanted higher standards. They wanted better curriculum. They wanted better prepared teachers. They never said, "Let's get rid of public education." That's the difference. Today, there is a very well-financed effort to dismantle public education.
Well, in the 60s, they talked about student-centered curriculum, and they talked about, you know, innovative education. And this whole marketing idea was supposed to create innovation and all kinds of new vistas for education. In fact, when we look at the record that you identified with, and were once very hopeful as far as school reform, it was all about choice, all about marketing, accountability, testing, these kinds of things, standardized testing. And now you come out and you say you went through a wrenching transformation. That's your language.
Right. Well, what happened was this. I've always been consistent in my view of what we need in education. And that is that I would like to see a great high-quality education for all children, no matter where they live, where they come from. And what has happened to education over the past 10 years or more, and this is what I describe in the book, is that this vision of a high-quality education has been completely taken over by a drive for higher test scores and training kids in basic skills. And it has created a vast test preparation industry where kids are being drilled and drilled and drilled. And then when they take a test that they weren't prepared for, they don't know the stuff. They really can't read very well. We have national reading scores that came out just a few weeks ago showing that reading has not improved among school children since 1998. So all of the billions that have been poured into testing and test prep turn out to be a waste, a loss. And so we've lost basically 10 years pushing this particular paradigm. What I want, which is high-quality education, turns out you can't get it either by testing or by promoting choice. Neither one of those will get us to that goal.
Well, in fact, you go into the whole voucher system, which was being touted as successful in Milwaukee, successful in Cleveland, successful in Washington, D.C., and pretty much the proof is not there.
The proof is not there. And what's sad about this is, first of all, it's sad it didn't work. But sadder still is the people who are promoting the idea of vouchers will not accept that it didn't work. There was just a study that came out this week of Milwaukee. Milwaukee is the city that's had publicly funded vouchers longer than any place else. They've had them since 1990. So we've had 20 years of vouchers in Milwaukee. And the latest study shows that there was no improvement in achievement at all. And so the kind of ultra-conservatives who've been promoting vouchers say, well, test scores really don't matter. So this is a new turn of events, because before they said test scores were the only thing that mattered. Now they're saying is since their experiment turned out not to work, they don't matter.
By the way, you have some conservative bona fides. I mean, you work definitely with Hoover and you work with the Bush administration.
I was a part of the Hoover Institution's Correct Task Force for 10 years. I was one of the founding members. I was also Assistant Secretary for Research in the first Bush administration. And so I do have...
That's with Lamar Alexander.
Lamar Alexander. Yeah. I've never been what's known as a movement conservative, but I've always had this vision of I want to see better education. So the thing about having these good conservative credentials is I know all the arguments on both sides. I particularly know the arguments from the right, which is where these ideas emanated. And I have many friends who believe that I'm wrong and they're right, but I think the evidence suggests that the path we've been on for these past 10 years is not working. And I think that one of the things that conservatives usually are very strong about is you follow the evidence and the facts where they take you. I like to quote John Adams, who was quoted by Ronald Reagan, who said, "Facts are stubborn things, and whatever our wishes, our inclinations, or the dictates of our passion, they cannot alter the facts or the evidence." So in this book, I'm going with the facts and the evidence and saying that choice is not going to, it may be nice and produces some great schools, it produces some terrible schools. Most of the choice schools, most of the charter schools will not be superior to regular public schools. And testing has not produced any education revolution. It is, in fact, in my view, it's dumbed down education.
Well, it's not only the conservatives, though. For example, I did an event a number of years ago with people from the Gates Foundation, and they're very much behind. They have been very much behind this business model for education. That is that schools ought to follow a business model, ought to perform and be accountable in the way businesses are and have that kind of trajectory behind them. You don't buy into that anymore either, do you?
No, I don't. In fact, there's a chapter in my book called The Billionaire Boys Club in which I take the Gates Foundation to task along with the Eli Broad Foundation, the Walton Family Foundation, and a few others. And regardless of the evidence, these foundations continue to pursue an agenda that is, I think, very harmful to education. First of all, the latest thing is merit pay. There's no evidence that merit pay produces better education. It's going to create a frenzy of teaching to the test. The Broad Foundation and several other foundations have just pumped millions and millions over to Michelle Rhee in Washington, D.C. To launch a big merit pay plan. Now, what merit pay does is it sets teacher against teacher. It destroys what is the most fundamental ethic of education, which is collaboration, and instead creates this competition for who can get the highest test scores. Well, you know, if your salary is tied to test scores, A, everybody's going to be doing test prep all the time, only on the things that are measured for money, and B, they're going to narrow the curriculum. If you're not going to pay people to produce a well-educated child who has gotten involved in the arts, well, their arts are going to be out. Everything that's not tested will be minimized.
Talking with Diane Ravitch, and her new book is The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education. When vouchers kind of fizzled out, as you point out in your book, suddenly charter schools became sort of the panacea. I mean, we don't really have a panacea or a silver bullet, as you, magic bullet, whatever, for education. But charter schools, in your judgment, have really not measured up either.
Well, you know, whenever I say anything negative about charter schools, I can count on having lots of dissent, because everyone can point to a charter school and say, look at that one. That one is a great charter school. And I do not deny that there are great charter schools. I believe there are. There are some that are doing wonderful things, have great curriculum. But on the whole, if you look at things like – if you look at the national test, and that the national test, the ones administered by the federal government, are the only tests that I give any credibility to, because no one can prepare for them. No one knows what's going to be on the test, and no one knows who's going to take the test. They're given to a sample of students, not to every student. So if you look at the national scores, which are not rigged the way so many state scores are, the charter schools have been compared to regular public schools since 2003. So 2003, 5, 7, and 9, charter schools have never outperformed regular public schools, not among black kids, not among Hispanic kids, not among low-income kids, and not in cities. So we now have, after 20 years of advocacy for charter schools, there are 5,000 charter schools right now in the United States. There's some small number of them that are excellent schools. There are some number that are horrible, and most of them are in between and overall no different from regular public schools. So the more the foundations push us to dismantle public education, create more charter schools, we will not see any bump in or improvement in the quality of education overall.
I think it's generally safe to say, though, that things are not necessarily things are maybe on a local level, grassroots level, going in the direction you want it to go. But from the administration, from the top down, from the White House, I mean, President Obama has endorsed merit pay. You've been critical of President Obama's educational agenda because it's been essentially the idea of the economists and the corporate types who believe that education ought to proceed from corporate-style reforms or management type of reforms, business reforms, as I said earlier. And in fact, you met with the Secretary of Education, didn't you?
I did. And Secretary Duncan was as they put it these days, I guess, the CEO of the Chicago Public Schools. And he did in Chicago precisely what he's now proposing to do in the United States, which is to close schools, open schools, open charter schools, fire teachers. I think this is the wrong agenda. This is a very destructive agenda. And we will actually be worse off if we have 8 years of this than if we were to pursue a more positive and constructive path of actually improving and strengthening the schools we have.
What do you say to somebody who says, public schools, I just can't get out of them, what I would like for my children, and therefore I'm going to probably look into private schools where teachers may make less money, but the kids can get a better education?
Well, I'd say be very careful, because there are a lot of very poor private schools or poor charter schools around. But, you know, ultimately every parent makes this decision for themselves. I've been a great friend and supporter of Catholic schools because, in general, Catholic schools do a great job, but they're dying off. They're dying off in particular these days because not only because the church doesn't have the money that it once had to sustain the schools, they don't have the free labor, but they now have the competition from charter schools, which are they claim to offer for free what the Catholic schools charge. I think that choosing a school is a very individual decision. But regardless of what parents may choose, and typically somewhere between 10 and 11% of parents choose private schools, what we now see is within the public sector, with public dollars, many schools are being privatized. They're being turned over to for-profit corporations or to, in some cases, nonprofit corporations that pay outlandish executive compensation. We have a small charter chain in New York City where the executive pays herself $400,000 a year, way more than the chancellor, who's responsible for over 1 million children. The little charter chain has 1,000 students, and the one with 1,000 students is paying outrageous compensation. So I think we're seeing what the original vision for charter schools was. I applaud. The original vision was that groups of public school teachers would be freed to take on the hardest cases, the kids who don't want to be in school, the kids who have no motivation, who would rather drop out or be someplace else, and that these teachers would work with the toughest kids and come back to the public schools with answers, solutions to the problems that would make public schools better. What we now have is a charter school sector that is aggressive, voracious, wants public school space, wants to kick the public schools out of their building and take their buildings over to save themselves rent. And it's become kind of bowing down to the idol of competition. But I think education is different from business, and that competition doesn't make things better.
You would like charter schools really to serve those who need them the most.
Exactly.
The failing students.
I mean, one of the things that I think I recommend in the book and that I've recommended wherever I've been speaking is I'd like to see charter schools do what the original vision was, help the kids who need help the most. But in order to do that, they have to be freed of this responsibility to produce higher test scores, because it's what's so toxic about test scores is not testing, because I actually don't disapprove of testing. What I disapprove of is the punitive accountability, where you say, if you don't get your scores up, we're going to close you down.
Well, you also think it causes dumbing down, because you're teaching to the test.
Not only does it cause dumbing down, when you attach high stakes to testing, as we have today, and as President Obama and President George W. Bush before him, they believed in this. They saw this as the business model. When you attach the high stakes, you not only get dumbing down, but you get cheating, gaming the system. You get states cheating, districts cheating, principals cheating, teachers cheating. Everybody's cheating because they want to avoid those sanctions.
Talking to Diane Ravitch again, her new book is The Death and Life of the Great American School System, and she was Assistant Secretary of Education in the Bush Senior Administration. She's here in town, and we'll give you an opportunity to speak with her and ask any questions or comments. You're looking for a national curriculum. Why?
Well, you know, I would love to see a national curriculum, and I can't say that I'm right now optimistic about it happening. I would like to see a national curriculum that included a specification of what we expect children to learn, but no punishments attached, just a guideline for teachers to use to know so that when there's so much mobility in our society, if you move from town to town, district to district, state to state, you should expect that you're not going to have to take state history. If you move three times, take state history again and again and again. I've seen kids who've had that experience, and because the districts had no coordination amongst them. I'd like to see a national curriculum that said all children will study the arts, that there will be the resources for all children to study the arts in history and science and geography and literature.
In fact, you advocated a reading list of literary classics.
I did.
Right early
yes,
on.
Yeah. I advocated that. In fact, in my last book, which was called The Language Police, there's actually not a reading list for everyone, but a very large reading list of literary classics that I think it would be wonderful if kids even read some of them. What kids are reading today are test prep materials, and that's why by the time they get to eighth grade, they don't have the vocabulary even to understand the questions.
So a lot of blame that's put on the unions, and I think you see things more sympathetically where the unions are concerned, don't you?
Well, I just feel that that teachers join unions and teachers have unions so that they can have a voice at the table. And I believe that the reason that unions right now are being demonized is to make sure that teachers are not part of the national consensus, they're not part of the national conversation. We now have a dominant consensus that's being shaped by, first of all, the billionaire foundations like Gates and Broad and Dell and a bunch of others, the Walton Family Foundation. So the foundations then fund the think tanks all over the country, but especially centered in D.C. The think tanks write studies that express the business model of merit, competition, choice, markets. Those advocacy pieces go out to the major editorial boards, and so you have the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Boston Globe, and the major media picking up on all these think tank pieces and saying, yeah, that's where it's at. It's the Obama administration, it's the Bush administration. Everyone agrees. And the only people missing from that consensus are people who work in schools. And the only way that they'll ever be heard is by having an organized voice. So I think, to me, the fundamental role of unions today is to try to get teachers a place at the table. And keeping them away from the table has been very important to the guys who are sitting there, because they don't want to hear the voice of experience. They don't want to hear teachers.
Kevin Guillory, our producer, just handed me this breaking news story. Breaking news, not breaking news, June 22nd, 2009, the Obama administration pushing for more charter schools. The teachers' union is pushing for a bigger role in them. I mean, that's pretty much status quo at this point. But I was going to ask you about No Child Left Behind. I mean, been a failure, utterly?
I think No Child Left Behind has been close to a complete failure. When people say, what's the good part? They'd say, well, you know, if you break down the test scores and you see how kids are doing who are from a low income or who are black or Hispanic, it's good that districts can't hide the scores of the low performing kids. The worst thing about No Child Left Behind, in my view, is, first of all, setting a utopian goal that 100% of all children will be proficient, and then following that up with punishments, saying that if you're not 100% proficient, we're going to close your school, we're going to privatize it, we're going to do a bunch of things, none of which have ever worked anywhere. And it just makes no sense to set a goal that's literally out of reach. I mean, we would all like to see 100% proficient, but it's never happened anywhere.
Then what do we do about the so-called achievement gap? Or what should we be doing?
Well, I think that minority kids need, they need a lot of things in terms of education. Certainly they need good teachers, wonderful teachers, people who understand where they are and can help lift them up. But they also, in many cases, they need health care. They need to have communities where they're safe. They need schools where they're safe. And in the lives that many children lead who are very, very poor, the situations in their community are such that the school is the most stable institution in their life. And this administration, the Bush administration, saw that the cure to their problem was to close their school. So they may, in many cases, be losing a social network that was protecting them, the teachers, the communities focused on that school. I just think this is the wrong answer to a set of questions where kids are in, let's say, their disadvantages associated with poverty. Most people would agree to that. But we have this kind of national consensus that says poverty doesn't matter. That is totally ridiculous because every test that's ever been given has a tight correlation between affluence and test scores. The kids who come from affluent communities have high scores. The kids who come from poverty have low scores. And it's not because they have different brains. They have different opportunity. And that opportunity, poverty constricts opportunity. So if we don't address the situation that the kids are living in, schools alone should not be bearing the blame. I do think that there's a lot schools can do to improve education for poor kids, but one would be to relieve them from this constant test prep, which restricts the quality of education they get. What they need is the broad experiences that schools provide, engaging in the arts, learning about science, learning about history, and giving them the kinds of activities that make school a compelling place. We see very high levels of dropping out, but also high levels of truancy from school, because school has become a very forbidding place under this regime of test, test, test.
If you're going to change the schools with the kind of reform program that you're talking about here, Start a Prairie Fire, I think you're going to need really a grassroots movement. You're going to need something that's going to come from the people themselves. Like I was involved in an event over at Marina Middle School, and there were 1,000 people who turned out, and they were very angry about school cuts. They were angry about schools not fulfilling their responsibilities, not really responding to teachers and putting teachers more central to the role in terms of educational change and innovation. You have to start a real populist movement, I think.
Well, there are two different things that need to happen. And one is to have a populist grassroots movement that says stop and says to the Obama administration, your program is no different from George W. Bush's program. George W. Bush's program has failed, and you should not be building on it. And the Obama plan, first the race to the top, is, I think, a terrible program. And I would love to see every state say, no, we will not participate. We don't want to be bribed by getting dollars to do the wrong thing. And the Obama race to the top is saying use the test scores to evaluate teachers, despite the fact that teachers are not uniquely responsible for student performance.
Let us bring our listeners into this discussion with Diane Ravitch. Again, her new book is The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education. If you have an opinion, please join us. If you have a question or comment, you can do so. 866-733-6786 is our toll-free number. You can call us now again at 866-733-6786 or send an email to us. forum@kqed.org is our email address. And you can also post a comment on our website just by visiting kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Diane Ravitch, the author of The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education. And she is a professor of the history of education at New York University and also former assistant secretary of education in the George H.W. Bush administration. She'll be appearing tonight from 5:30 to 6:30 at the Cubberley Auditorium at Stanford University School of Education, and tomorrow evening at Sibley Auditorium at UC Berkeley from 5:30 to 7:30. And I want to go to your calls and emails. But first, Diane had mentioned before we went to the air that there may be two ways to bring up serious change here, and you hit one, and I wanted you to mention the second.
Well, you know, there's the things you do short term, and that is just stop punishing teachers, stop firing teachers, stop closing schools, develop a more sensible evaluation system where if a school is in trouble, you actually have expert educators go there and find out why it's in trouble, come up with a remedial plan, and then provide the resources to fix the problems. It may be a school where all the kids, most of the kids don't speak English and can't even read the test, and then it'll need more people to help teach the kids English. It's that sort of one-on-one, fix the problem rather than close the school, which I think is very destabilizing. The second part, though, of what we need to do is to develop what I consider a long-term plan. We should be looking not 4 years down the road, but 15 years down the road. Have a 15-year or 20-year plan where we say we're going to change the intake into education. We're going to require that all future teachers have at least a major in something that they're going to teach in school, possibly two, so that everyone in the school, even in elementary schools, has a major in, let's say, history and music, art and science, some combination where you just have these riches of knowledge. And then beyond that, you need to have teachers who know how to teach, who know how to control a classroom, things of that sort. But we need to begin to think about building the teaching profession. We've been through now 10 years of destroying the profession of education, where we have superintendents who've never been in a school except as a student. They're businessmen, they're lawyers, they're admirals, they're generals, whatever. We should have professional educators running school systems, making decisions about curriculum, instruction, and personnel. We need principals who are actually themselves master teachers, because they're the ones who are supposed to evaluate the teachers, decide who gets hired, who gets tenure, who needs help, and then is able themselves to make those decisions about how to help them. And instead, we're creating overnight programs to turn people who have no teaching experience into principals. So I think if we could rebuild the profession, change the nature of our tests so that they actually test comprehension rather than snap answers to bubble questions. And I think we would begin to see some long, 15 years from now, we will see a dramatic change in our system, but we can't do it overnight. And it's this overnight thinking that the politicians want to do, where they set short-term goals, where people cheat to get the right data. We're on the wrong track.
Let me add one thing, and it's maybe my own hobby horse because I've been an educator for a long time. And that is, and I don't know how you do this, but changing the culture in the sense that teachers are always accorded kind of a rhetorical respect. You know, people say it's a noble profession. It's great that you've decided to teach, and there's a lot of encouragement for it. But the fact of the matter is that in many ways, it's not given the kind of professional elevation. I mean, I'm not only talking about wages here. Mm-hmm. I'm just talking about the kind of respect that right. I think hardworking teachers deserve.
Well, right now, I'd say that teachers are more discouraged than I've ever seen them in my lifetime, because there is a public rhetoric that is very abusive. Newsweek a few weeks ago had a cover story saying the key to saving education is firing bad teachers, giving the impression that schools are overrun with bad teachers, and they're not. You have to ask who hires them, who evaluates them, who gives them tenure. Maybe we should fire bad administrators.
Well, there are a lot of bad teachers. Maybe it's because of bad administrators. I mean, I don't know, chicken or the egg, but, I read the Newsweek article.
I thought the article was terrible because it suggested that the answer to all our problems, first of all, was to wipe out public education and then to replace them with non-union charter schools that have teachers that work 60, 70, 80 hours a week, burn out in 2 years, gone, and they get replaced. And we will never have a great education system based on this really horrible abusive, burning out teacher model.
Can we also, just for a moment before I go to calls, you and I agree about the fact that it's sad in many ways that California, and you worked here in 1985 mm-hmm. with right. Bill Honig, who was then superintendent of schools. California lost the leadership of Bill Honig.
Right. Well, I think Bill Honig is still one of the great educators in America, and it's really a tragedy that he, I think that he was done in by politics. In my experience, having met lots of superintendents across the country and people who are now leading the education dialogue, to me, Bill Honig is still the wisest.
He was also done in by a talk show host who's now serving time in a penitentiary, but we won't go there. Let's go to our callers instead. And we begin with Susan. Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to say as a parent that I wholeheartedly agree with your guest, and I want to stand up and applaud her. She is speaking to the choir, and as parents, what can we do? My child has totally lost interest in school because of testing, constant testing, and we've, been talking to the teachers and talking to the administrators, and these are really good teachers and good administrators in a very strong district. But in some ways, their hands are tied. And so as a parent, what can we do to kind of help continue this dialogue to create some change?
Well, first thing, of course, I would recommend is that you read my book. And I don't say that in a self-interested way, but simply because it would give you the ammunition to fight harder. Alone, you can do nothing. You have to organize with other parents. You have to join with parents, hopefully, and teachers. And I was speaking the other night at UCLA, and someone asked that question. I said, why don't you organize a sit-in at George Miller's office? You have the most important congressman on the education questions right here in California, and he does not understand what No Child Left Behind has done. No Child Left Behind is still the law of the land. It will be for maybe another year or two until some laws, new laws, passed. Obama is going to continue some of the worst penalties of No Child Left Behind, with closing schools, firing teachers, and things of this kind, and focusing, everyone will, under the new Obama proposal, every child will still be tested in reading and math. Every school will still be judged by the test scores. So that part won't change. And that's why I think you must begin to do political action to reach the people who represent you in Congress.
Thank the caller. Here's a listener. That caller says, preaching in a choir, and was very enthusiastic. Here's someone who comes from a more critical point of view. Brian writes, I'm on a small school district board and study education. It's sad to hear Dr. Ravitch paint black and white education pictures. She herself notes that federal tests do a better job than states. The issue isn't tests or no tests. It's the need to develop tests that avoid the problems she defines. The issue isn't merit pay or not. It's the need to develop merit pay that avoids her problems. Black and white versions are simple for sound bites and selling books, but it's not a mature way to improve education.
Well, I think that's wrong. First of all, if you read my book, you'd see that I say very flat out, I'm not opposed to testing. I think we need testing to see whether the kids are moving backwards or forwards. I am opposed to the misuse of testing to punish schools and teachers, because as soon as you begin to have this accountability and based on test scores, and you give either big rewards or big punishments, you get cheating. And I have a chapter on accountability, Chapter 8, where I describe the way that states are cheating, districts are cheating, schools are cheating, and teachers are cheating because they're so afraid of the sanctions and so eager for the rewards.
Another listener says, please ask your guest to describe the difference in the federal test scores, the only test she likes, between schools with unionized teachers and schools with non-union teachers. If she doesn't know or doesn't care, ask her why not.
Well, you know, here's the thing about unions. Unions neither, and I explain this in the book, neither unions neither cause nor stand in the way of improved test scores. If you look for high-scoring districts, the highest-scoring district in the country on the national test is Massachusetts. Massachusetts is 100% union. The highest-scoring nation in the world on the international test is Finland. Finland is 100% union. I don't think that Massachusetts is at the top because it has unions, but it didn't stop them from being at the top. If you look at the lowest-scoring states in the United States, they have very weak unions or no unions. So unions are not the problem.
Let me go to more of your calls, and we'll go next to Oakland, Virginia, who is a teacher joining us online. Good morning.
Actually, I'm a retired teacher, and good morning.
Oh, you're always a teacher, Virginia. Once a teacher, always a teacher.
That's absolutely true. I began teaching in the 50s. I've taught all grade levels from preschool up through college. And even in the 50s, I resented testing because it was a waste of teaching time. We didn't teach to the tests, but we spent a week giving the tests. Testing should really guide instruction. And one of the things that's wrong with the standardized tests is the teachers don't get results back in time to have it guide their instruction. Testing needs to come from teachers for the programs that they're teaching, not be something else that's just placed on top that's really never used except for real estate people to sell houses and people to criticize education. I also want to agree with the arts in education. I taught at Skyline High in Oakland, which is the performing arts magnet school. Our students, a lot of them said, the only reason why I come to school is for the arts programs. My own daughter said, and she's an honors student, now an attorney, said, Mom, I have to have at least one class that I can look forward to. So I agree with the guest about all the things about teaching and testing.
And we thank you for the call. We'll go to more of your calls. We'll go next to San Jose. And Dilip, good morning. Is that the right name, Dilip? Caller
Hello?
From San Jose? Yes, sir. You're on the air. What's your name?
My name is Dilip.
Dilip. Okay. I got the name right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Talk to us. You're on the air.
Yeah. My question to your guest was, she mentioned about some national score where the charter schools and the public schools were the same and the charter schools were not better off in any way. How about comparing in that score that which was supposedly fair? How do private schools compare with above average public schools? By above average, I mean from the affluent areas, because you cannot compare with other areas.
Okay, what do we know on that score?
Well, the federal test is called the National Assessment of Educational Progress. It's given to scientific samples of students in every state across the nation, and the scores come out every 2 years in odd years. They're tested in reading and in math. They also give tests in other subjects, but they don't always have state tests. Now, they do compare private schools and public schools. Private schools consistently get higher scores, but you have to remember that the kids who go to private schools are paying, and their families are more affluent, and the single best predictor of test scores is poverty and affluence.
Here's a listener who asked a question. I was interested to hear that vouchers in charter schools do not perform at a level any higher than public schools. Do you know if they obtain equivalent performance for lower, equal, or higher per student expenditure?
Well, charter schools initially said that they would. This would be a big reform because it saves so much money. Because after all, they wouldn't have all the bureaucracy, and so they would. In many states, when they created charter programs, allotted them less money. And within a few years, the charter schools began complaining that it wasn't fair. They were getting less money than the regular public schools. They said, "We too are public schools. We should get just as much money." So there is no cost saving in charter schools, because even though they may actually be spending less per student, they're also paying very, very high executive compensation. Not every charter school does, but many of them do, and especially the big charter chains have very high executive compensation.
Here's a listener named Kimberly who says, I'm a public high school teacher currently home listening because I was called for jury duty. I commend what Ms. Ravitch has been saying recently and with a strong voice. It is what we on the front lines of education and its reform have been saying for years. The current direction does nothing to close the achievement gap. We blame teachers and their unions instead of supporting the experience and knowledge they bring with them. By the way, exactly how does one determine merit for the arts, PE, et cetera, whose programs often are the one area where struggling kids can realize their abilities instead of their deficits?
Well, here's an interesting example of how a state is trying to do, do merit pay for everybody. Florida, in the last few days, passed a law saying that they're going to wipe out any credit on a teacher's salary related to experience or education and base half of their salary on test scores. And when there was a complaint about, hey, you only test reading and math, they said, we're going to develop new tests in every subject, and we're going to deduct 5% from every district spending to pay for the development of these new tests. There's a way of cutting education spending and just devoting more and more to tests. And you can kind of envision the nightmare in Florida when everything is tested and there's no time for instruction, just test.
Speaking of test, here's a listener from Francie who raises an interesting question. She says, has anyone studied the end result of higher test scores? In other words, do students who go to schools who have raised their test scores do better in life than students who attended the school earlier? Are their rates of voter participation higher? Their rates of incarceration lower? Do they earn more money? I've yet to see a study that looks at what happens to students after they're done with school and correlates that with their test scores.
Well, I don't know of such a study, but I can also say that some of the states are lowering their standards to produce higher scores. And the kids then they have a higher graduation rate. But then when the young people go into college, it turns out that they can't even read, write, and do math. The remediation rates haven't gone down at all. In some cases, they're going up. And in New York City, where I live, of the high school graduates, 75% of them require remediation. So that is not a very good testament to their higher scores.
Diane Ravitch's book is The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education. And Wade is our next caller. Good morning, Wade. Wade, right in here.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a professor at a local medical school, and although it's not germane to the public education system per se, what we've dealt with, most of our teachers who teach in the medical school are voluntary faculty. They aren't compensated for their time. They do it out of the love of teaching, which I think most teachers do anyway. But we had to deal with quality of teachers as well, and the way we deal with it is by student evaluations primarily. Students evaluate every faculty member, and we decide which teachers to retain in our courses based upon how well they fare as an effective teacher in the student's eye. So I like the idea of moving towards systems where you applaud split teachers based upon some perceived standard and not clearly not financial.
Well, I have to say, Wade, that I can't agree with you, and maybe you're right and I'm wrong, but I've always hated this idea that students will evaluate the teachers and professors because it makes the teachers and professors pander to the students. It makes them fearful of assigning too much. The students will complain if they have too much to read, if they have too much homework. If the teacher has high standards, they'll complain about that. And you really I want to see teachers who feel strong enough to be able to set higher standards and not be afraid of their students. I also have a lot of concern about California having this parent trigger where schools are afraid of offending their parents, and so they have to pander to the parents. We really have to have some professional autonomy where the people who know their – first of all, you have teachers who really know their subject, know how to teach, set high standards, and then are able to be authority figures rather than fear the opinion of those that they are educating.
And I thank the caller. Here's somebody who's a professor in education who says, frankly, I'm sick to death of former Bush administration staffers coming out of the closet with their mea culpas and expecting us to fund their conversion. When the author describes well-funded, uniformed amateurs, she is speaking about her former boss and his colleagues who have driven education into the ground. Bush et al. Ignored informed, heavily evidence-based research and were blind, deaf, and dumb to anyone who didn't support their well-funded, amateur-led educational policies.
Well, I may be the only Bush administration official who's saying this, so I guess he's just talking about me, so I'm sorry.
Another listener says, so pleased to hear Diane Ravitch this morning. While my colleagues and I are in the midst of a struggle with district leadership, who should be our allies and a federal administration we helped and supported, she says what those of us working to close the achievement gap in urban schools have been saying for years, and she lays out loudly and clearly exactly why we are not listened to. Another listener, Will, writes, my child goes to a school in an affluent school district. Voter-approved taxes and parent donations more than match the funds we get from the state. So in essence, my child's school gets twice the money of a school in a less affluent area. Some pundits will say you can't throw money at education. Affluent school districts prove that. Throwing money at education helps tremendously.
Sure. You know, the people who say that money doesn't matter are the people whose kids are very well provided for. I've never heard a poor parent in a poor district say that money doesn't matter.
On to more calls. And Helene, join us. Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to thank you so much for your work. I taught in an elementary school for 7 years, now teach at a community college. And what I plan to do, because what you're saying makes total sense to me, I pulled over here in the parking lot before I go into work. I'm going to buy 4 copies of your book. I'm going to read one. I'm going to send one to Oprah. I'm going to send a third to Obama, maybe the first one to Obama. He's a smart man. I think he can take in the information and perhaps turn the course here. And I guess the next one to George Miller. But I just want to thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call. And on we go to another caller. Michael, that's you. Good morning.
Hi, Michael. Wonderful to hear you again. And I just want to make my story brief. I'm just a hardworking cabbie in San Francisco, and 13 years ago, I was committed to have my son in French American International School because I feel that America has fallen behind the rest of the world community, not realizing the importance of languages so children can be introduced through language as a catalyst for the world community and be able to reach out and contribute and be happy and confident to be anywhere in the world. And languages has been proven be simulated when they're very young and improve his cognitive abilities and other subjects. And after 13 years, I've struggled to put him in through this school, and the results have been absolutely fantastic. 4 years of Mandarin, fluent in French, and he sees the world as a young man, and now he's off to university, and I'm very proud of him and very proud of me because I didn't see public schools as an option, really. They're not preparing children for the world.
Thank you for the call. Probably many people have a similar story to tell about public schools or as opposed to private schools.
Well, you know, again, I think that when people are willing to pay for something different, that's their right. It's a free country. But we still need to have a good public education system. I've looked at the international data and you know, where countries are succeeding. I don't know of a successful country that doesn't have a strong public education system. I've seen some countries that are struggling that have terrible problems of poverty and illiteracy, where their public education system is almost non-existent. And one of the first things they need to do to pick up their country and raise their aspirations and live higher, you know, have a higher standard of living, is to create a strong public education system. So I think it would be a terrible mistake for us, on the basis of anecdotes, to parcel out our public education system to the highest seller, or highest buyer.
There's a listener formerly in San Francisco, now listening to us in Lima, Peru, named Art, who says, I understand the drive for charter schools and school choice to be predominantly in disadvantaged locations, such as inner cities and lower income students. You can't compare a charter school in Milwaukee with Gunn or Palo Alto High School. Can we hear the public schools' makeup of the statistics that say the charter schools are not performing? Shouldn't the Milwaukee comparisons be with the Milwaukee public schools, not nationwide?
Oh, they are the comparisons with the Milwaukee public schools.
That's
they're all failing. The public school system's failing. The charter school sector's failing. And the voucher sector is failing. The other thing about, and it's true that most charters are located in inner city neighborhoods, and what they do typically is to bring to, whether they have a lottery or they simply enroll kids, is that they will bring in X number of students, but they will have a lower percentage of kids with special needs. They'll have a lower percentage of kids with limited English proficiency. And then in many, many cases, they will kick kids out because they're disruptive, because they have low scores. They'll counsel them out. They'll keep them until they get the funding for a year, and then they'll return them to the public school. So many of these miracle stories you hear about charter schools are schools that have, sure, all the kids are Black and Hispanic. They're maybe all low income, but they don't have the same number of kids with low English speaking and special needs as the regular public school. And they have that ability to remove kids, which the public schools don't. So they may start with 100 kids and end up with 40. And then they'll say to the public school, we're better than you are. But the public school has all the kids that they didn't take.
Well, here's another point of view. Anybody who's been through public schools knows the following three problems. One, bad teachers don't get fired. Two, bad students don't get kicked out. Three, there's not enough money. Charter schools are supposed to fix two of the three, right? Seems like a good thing to me. Your guest claims the test data say charter schools aren't that good, but in the same breath, she disparages test scores for not measuring what's important. So which is it?
Well, here's the longer, the bigger problem with charter schools. Charter schools today are consuming basically all the media ink. I mean, the media ink goes either to saying public schools are terrible and charter schools are a miracle. But charter schools enroll 3% of the kids in the public school sector in the United States. And even in places like California and New York, where there are a lot of charter schools, they enroll between 3 and 5%, at most 10%. So while we talk and talk and talk about what charter schools do or don't do, the system that enrolls 90 to 97% of the kids continues to be underfunded in many places, and we're not developing a plan for how we fix it, because we're focused totally on how can we give away public schools to entrepreneurs.
Eva in Walnut Creek, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. My name is Eva, and I'm an involved parent of public school children. Our Walnut Creek schools are doing great. We have very forward-thinking superintendent and boards. And I would like to say that I believe that our community is very affluent and able to give to the schools, but I believe all of our children across the state need the same efforts. And I did want to mention that we're doing since education in California has taken a cut of about $17.8 billion over the past 3 years, and it looks like it's going to be cut again, there's going to be a rally in Contra Costa at College Park High School tomorrow afternoon at 4:30. Our elected officials are going to come and speak on behalf of rallying to support funding for our public schools, which is direly needed. It's just such an affront to see that prison budgets haven't been cut to the degree or at all compared to the huge hit that public education has gotten. And I really was listening to the topic of your book. I'm going to read it and also try to pass it on to our board members. So thank you very much. It was an epiphany to hear what you're saying. So.
And thank you for the call, and good luck with the rally.
Thank you. If I could just raise this question, which to me is very puzzling. Why is it at the national level we say banks are too big to fail, and yet we're closing schools? To me, that makes no sense. We have people with billions and billions of dollars, but we don't have enough to fund our public education system that will represent the future of our nation.
Casey, thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
Yeah, in all of these discussions, I've never really heard much of an explanation towards, like, where kids' role in all of this is. We want to give them more money or take their money away or make them public or private schools. But when I was in school, most of the kids that did bad because they didn't care and they didn't want to be there. And I don't think any amount of money or that sort of thing would get them involved in that. I think it's more a matter of interest. If they're interested, they'll be interested. If they're not interested, they're not interested. And I've never heard anybody really speak to that, so I had that question for your guest.
Well, thank you for making that point, because this is why it's so ridiculous to judge teachers largely by their students' test scores, because there are kids who are unmotivated, and it's not the teacher's fault. The teacher may be knocking herself or himself out and have students who are slackers and who would rather be at the beach or working or doing anything, and yet the teachers are going to be judged by the test scores of those students who don't care. And so, we got to be concerned about all kids, but we shouldn't punish the teachers if they happen to get some rotten apples one year.
But we need inspiring teachers, and we need dedicated and committed teachers. I mean, right. That goes without saying.
No, we also need to have responsible families and families who understand that they're the kids' first teachers, who do all the things that we know need to be done.
To be the school and the home, and working
absolutely.
Together, ideally.
It, absolutely.
Yeah. So good to have you here. Thank you.
It's wonderful to be with you, Michael.
Diane Ravitch, again, her book is The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. We're going to talk with Ian McEwan in the hour ahead. His new novel is called Solar, Booker Prize-winning novelist. And we invite you to let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum simply by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or calling our listener call-in line at 415-553-3300. Our thanks to senior editor Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, and Erica Kelly. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And thanks again for being here on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.